Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in London, England, and modeled for 10 years in London, Milan, Paris, and New York City, and then transitioned to fashion photography. He was a judge for 8 seasons on Tyra Banks' reality show, America's Next Top Model, and the host of The Face. His latest book is entitled Models of Influence, 50 Women Who Reset the Course of Fashion. His name, Nigel Barker, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Nigel Barker, who in February of 2013 became the host of The Face. Nigel, welcome. A real honor to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in London, England, and your mom and your dad, please?
Absolutely. My goodness. Okay, we're taking it right back to the beginning then, obviously. I mean, just to give you a little history of myself, I am, as you mentioned, I'm an Englishman. I grew up in England. I grew up in London. But during the 70s in England, there were not that many children of mixed heritage. And my mother is Sri Lankan. My father is English and Irish. And I remember growing up being one of the very few children who was, looked different than the average English boy. And not that I was bullied so much, but rather, as a kid, you look for others who sort of resemble you, and certainly when you get asked questions as to why you look different on a regular basis, you sort of look at yourself in the mirror and say, well, who am I? Why am I different? And, this little island of Sri Lanka didn't mean much to me when I grew up in England, other than a sort of a pearl-shaped, island off the coast of India on a map. My mother tried to tell me things about my heritage, but the reality is that I was growing up an English boy. So, it was a very, an interesting time in England and in London, and I think the world at large, mixed heritage was just beginning to sort of rise. 60s, 70s, you were beginning to see more and more of it. But it was still early days. So, it was a fun time, an unusual time, a tough time. And at the same time, I had a very lucky and privileged childhood. My parents did very well for themselves. My mother was a model and got involved in the entertainment industry. She was a singer and performed on stage and a few other things as well. My father was a financial consultant, and they took care of us in many, many ways. And I certainly had an incredible education. I went to some of the best schools in England, a boarding prep school for boys called Skatecliff, which I was there from 9 to 13. And then I went to another boarding school called Bryanston in Dorset, southwest England, from 13 to 18. So, in many respects, I left home at the age of 8, 9 years old to go to boarding school, which helped shape the man you are. But it also was, again, one of those things where at those schools, finding yourself and, discovering who you are is a big part of it. And that journey, and again, looking different, looking slightly different. I was the only child of color at my first school. And then of course, at my next school, there was one other child who was an African-American, an African child who ended up becoming an incredible athlete who performed at the high jump at the Olympics for Zambia. But he was the only other child who was even remotely dark skin. And funny thing is now, of course, no one really looks at me and thinks, oh, you're dark-skinned. They just see me as a person, as a man of my accomplishments and what I've done and all the rest of it. But the interesting thing for me was at that moment in time, I was somewhat defined by it, partly because of the questions and all the rest of it. The reason why I'm talking about that so much is because in many respects, it's been a big part of my life, and you know, the various television shows I've worked on, you know, America's Next Top Model, which I was the judge and photographer for 17 seasons. A large part of the conversation for Miss Tyra Banks, world-class supermodel, was the lack of color on the runways and her desire to show more color in fashion. And, of course, my more recent partner on television, Miss Naomi Campbell, another celebrated and, of course, iconic supermodel who is an African Brit, and her mission as well to get more color on the runways and in television and on and all those various mediums of entertainment. So it's been a large part of my story, and certainly when I started my world into fashion, it was a sort of almost a homecoming in many respects, because, you know, it was the one place where the fashion industry is mixed of people who in many cases are the oddballs in their classroom, or the ones who sort of perhaps didn't fit in and were somewhat avant-garde, or had, you know, thoughts that weren't conventional, as in, you know, they didn't want to necessarily go to study medicine or do math or do science. They would rather draw and do art and liberal sciences, and, you know, and that particular group of people, you know, you often find themselves on the sort of the border of what everyone else is doing. And, you know, the fashion world is a place where they all come together. So for me, in many respects, when I started getting involved in fashion, which I did at the early age of around 16, actually, I was the only boy at my class of 24 girls, because there was a mixed boarding school, my last one. Although I played rugby and I was one of the boys when it came to that kind of thing, certainly during, you know, my free time, rather, I would go and do dressmaking, tailoring, pattern cutting, weaving, and learning all aspects of the fashion business, because I was fascinated in it. So, you know, my childhood was an interesting one where I was good at biology, chemistry, physics, and maths, and I was destined to become a doctor, actually. My parents had wanted me to go to study medicine, and I applied to Guy's Hospital and London Hospital, and I had grades that would hopefully qualify me to get in. And instead of doing that, of course, I took a road towards fashion. My mother, and be careful, parents, what you let your children do, or rather, you know, advise them to do. My mother entered me into a TV competition, one of the very first modeling televised competitions ever in the late 80s, on a TV show in England called The Clothes Show, and it was the very first model search they ever did. And she entered me onto this competition, and I didn't particularly want to do it. I just didn't really mind. I thought my mum had modeled, and I thought it'd be a bit of fun and maybe a way to make some money before I went to medical school. And of course, one thing led to another. I didn't win. I got in the top three. I was offered a contract by an English agency, and I thought, okay, we'll give it a year, travel the world. And what happened was, of course, I got introduced to the fashion world. I got introduced to modeling and photography and fashion design on a level that I'd never really experienced, other than at school doing my humanities courses. And, of course, fell in love with the people and the lifestyle and the travel and what was possible, and, you know, the fact that dreams and fantasies could be created and made, and, you know, and certainly traveling to America for the very first time as a young boy at 18 years old, and living in New York and staying at the Chelsea Hotel and, you know, in the Lower East Side, and all these sorts of things made your eyes bulge and, of course, full of wonder. So 1 year led to 2 years, led to 3 years, led to my parents saying, you've got to go to medical school now, and me saying, well, actually, I don't want to, and having the means to turn them down. So, again, like I said, be careful, parents, what you allow your children to do.
We're talking to Nigel Barker, who today is the man behind the lens. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Nigel Barker, who, after 10 years of modeling in London, Milan, Paris, New York City, you decide to get into photography. Nigel, how and why?
Well, you know, things change. Life changes. And, you know, and you want to move on. I mean, I had a great run at modeling, and it was just shy of a decade. And, you know, I started in the late 80s. I'd always had an interest in photography. It wasn't necessarily my one passion growing up at school. I enjoyed it. And at the a tender age of around 14, I had learnt to print black and white pictures at school as a sort of a part-time hobby. And, you know, I would run around school with one of my cameras. My mother brought me my first camera when I was only, I think, 12 years old. It was a Kodak Brownie. And I used to load medium format film into that and run around and shoot. And, of course, I had the use of a Pentax and a Nikon when I was at school, and would shoot various sporting events and theatrical events and music events for the school. And I remember early on noticing, as I was shooting, how, you know, when you put the pictures up on the 24-hour board, which is this board we had at school, I'd put little prints up, and they would be for sale, and children could buy them for, you know, a dollar or whatever it cost to print them. There was no money to be really made in them, but you noticed that the prints that sold were always the ones where certainly everyone looked good, but rather, you know, there was a certain magic to that picture, that it wasn't just a reportage image. It was a feeling or an emotion was in that picture of anguish or of strength or of, you know, whatever it was. And so I started to try and orchestrate pictures that looked like that specifically. I remember setting up, you know, a goal with a ball and having the goalkeeper in the foreground and then the kids trying to kick the ball into the goal, and I would photograph that moment of kicking and scoring and capturing, and that was actually a far more successful photograph for me to sell than it was if I just was at the football match and hoping for something to happen. So I learned early on an element of fashion very early on. I mean, or rather, the value of photography rather very early on. And, you know, it, for me, I guess, as I was modeling, not having any real idea of what kind of money a photographer could make, or what kind of lifestyle a photographer could make, because there was no degree courses, as you know, when I was a child in photography, that simply wasn't an offer. You know, if you wanted to become a photographer, you most likely assisted or interned at a photography studio, and you learnt the ropes from a master photographer or someone who was working as a photographer. And there were very few fashion photographers, and certainly their studios seemed to be, you know, almost ethereal. You couldn't find them. You didn't know where to even look for them. And even today, it's hard to get in contact with most fashion photographers. It's not like a wedding photography studio or something where you see the sign outside and you can go in. So working as a model, that was my first, you know, impression, when I really realized what the life of a fashion photographer was and what they did and how it worked and the control they had and the freedom they had and the age in which they could shoot to. And of course, myself as a model, I was working in the late 80s as a model in the early 90s, and that was a very sort of intoxicating time. If you think about who was modeling then, Christy Turlington, Linda Evangelista, Naomi Campbell, it was a moment where supermodels were really becoming household names, and in many respects it was the time when the word super was stuck on the word model. You know, the world was booming, world economies were booming, that late 80s was full of excess, it was an intoxicating time. You know, everything from the television shows to the fashion to the style, everything that was happening at that moment was really over the top. And, you know, it was a time when supermodels were saying things like, I won't get out of bed for less than $10,000, you know. And of course, like anything and like everything, things change. Times change and fashion change. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4". I was well built. I'd played rugby at school. I'd swam. And I was ideal for that late 80s sort of excessive, over-the-top kind of guy. The female models were voluptuous and, you know, buxom and had big hair and swagger and all the rest of it. And then, of course, came a recession of the early 90s, mid-90s, and came, you know, if you think about what happening in music at that moment, you had Kurt Cobain and, you know, singing lyrics which were anti-commercialism, and, you know, so that whole movement started, and it was, and fashion mimicked what was happening really as a mirror of society, and, you know, that heroin chic look that you heard about so much, that androgynous waif model, the Kate Mosses of this world who arose at that moment, and the designers, the Marc Jacobs, Anna Sui, who really had that street style, and that, you know, it was really a reaction to the excesses of the late 80s. It was a I don't want to have anything to do with all of that, that you don't represent me. And just like a sort of a disgruntled teenager, the next decade came along and looked at the last decade, you know, as a disgruntled teenager to a parent and said, I want to be nothing like you. I'm going to have my own look and feel. And actually, I'm a bit embarrassed about the way you showed off so much. And I'm going to do the absolute opposite. Now, there wasn't much I could do about the way I looked physically. I wasn't about to become a waif model. I couldn't shed 100 pounds off my body, and I couldn't make myself small or look effeminate. However, I'd spent almost a decade modeling and had learned so much from the industry, loved it. And so I started to transition. I saw what was happening. I could see how things were changing. And I started to transition into becoming a photographer. And in sort of 96 in the States, I opened a photo studio up in the Meatpacking District, an area which is now synonymous with fashion and photographers, but back then was very much an artist enclave and, a meatpacking zone that was not particularly nice, rather stinky because of all the meat, but was the only area that I could afford to be in that I could get a nice studio-sized spot. And, it was also rather fortuitous because it became a very sort of cool and trendy area now. But I set myself up then, and it took me sort of really 2 to 4 years to really get going. I started off as a test photographer, and I never really assisted anybody. But as a model, I worked for hundreds of photographers, many of the world's best photographers. And, I was always very alert to what they were doing, how they were shooting, and how they treated the people they photographed. Did they have empathy? Did they show empathy towards their subjects? Some did, some didn't. Some were all about the lighting. In fact, sometimes their lack of communication was exactly the kind of reaction they wanted from you. They wanted you to feel slightly out of place and awkward, because that created a kind of a look and a feeling that helped the style of their pictures. Others were very communicative and chatted with you and talked to you. And, Bruce Weber, for example, would create a party scene and you would be a part of that moment. And he would then shoot it and capture it. And, it was, you felt very much in the moment, even though it was being, orchestrated. And so that was my education in photography. And, of course, working as a model too, understanding what it was like to be photographed. I use that a lot still to this day. And my wife now, who was my girlfriend at the time, and we've been together for 22 years, was my muse, my very first muse, and she has an identical twin sister, so she was also my muse. And they would do elaborate photo shoots for magazines like Italian Vogue and German Vogue and all what have you, and come back after their shoots, and I had a sort of worked out a deal with them that they weren't to rub off their makeup or take down their hair until they got home. Most models will often take off their makeup and undo their hair on set before they leave, so they don't look like a scene as they walk down the streets. But I'd asked them not to, so that when they got to back home, I could then photograph them with this professional makeup and wonderful hair styles quickly for 30 minutes before they washed it off. And so I built my portfolio over the course of sort of 2 to 4 years, shooting them and then their friends and their friends' friends, and these, all these models started to see what I was doing and they liked what I was doing, and I built my book that way, and I transitioned from one side to the other. It was really force majeure in many respects.
We're talking to Nigel Barker, who for a number of seasons was a judge on the reality show America's Next Top Model. And I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasoola, and we're with Nigel Barker, who since 2014 has been partnering with Mr. Art Van Alslander. Nigel, tell us about AV Mr. Van.
Well, I've had the absolute honor and privilege of working with him, collaborating with him and his incredible company over the past couple of years, as you mentioned. And, our relationship, both working and personal, has been the most organic relationship I think I perhaps might have ever fostered. I have been close friends of another well-known Michigander family, the DeVos family, specifically a lady by the name of Pamela, who has a fashion label called Pamela Rowland, and I had been photographing her collection in New York and in Michigan for a few years, and became friends with their family, and had been introduced to Michigan and from shooting over there and just from the family, and we had been invited to go and stay at one of their houses in Bay Harbor near Harbor Springs in that part of northern Michigan. And we had been vacationing there, and it was actually on our very first time there. I was there with my wife and my two children, and we were at the pool at the club they have there. And the DeVosses had a cabana that I was staying at, and this gentleman was sitting in the cabana next door. And I remember, I guess he knew that was the DeVosses' cabana. And there he sees me sitting in this cabana. And not that he asked me to, you know, who was I, what was I doing in this person's cabana, but rather he sort of, this gentleman who I didn't know, looking rather distinguished, sitting next to me in this other cabana. And they're rather nicely appointed cabanas, obviously. And he said to me, well, I'd just like to introduce myself. I'm Mr. Art Van. And I, at that point, wasn't fully aware of everybody and everything that was happening in Michigan and in the area. And I didn't fully realize or comprehend that I was speaking to the Mr. Art Van. And of course, I think he might have called himself Elslander at the same time, Mr. Art Van Elslander. So I didn't fully appreciate it. Now, the interesting and the good part of that is, of course, that when one doesn't realize who somebody else is, and you just meet and you talk and you actually like one another for completely organic reasons, you're able to strike up a friendship that's absolutely real and authentic. And that's exactly what happened. So we sat there that particular day and chatted for the odd hour and a half, I think, over lunch, as we both had lunches on separate tables but talked back and forth. And he was talking about his work in line of work and furniture, and very, very humbly. Didn't mention the stores or all the rest of it. Just was just talking more on an artistic level. And I was talking about photography and all the rest of it. And we just chatted back and forth. And we then went on to bump into each other a couple of times that visit. And I remember one party specifically where we walked in. I don't think he knew too many people at that party, and we certainly didn't know anybody. And he saved a space at his table next to him. And, we sat down again and chatted. Now, this happened for 2 or 3 years. We would see each other every year, same time, same place, as I was guest of the DeVos family, and he was up there. He has a house there too. And we just became friends. And it was a wonderful thing. And I remember, about 2 or 3 years ago, I suggested, that I would love to photograph him. And he said, well, that would be wonderful. I'm going to be in New York doing a bit of shopping and looking at the various, styles and things that are happening at New York during Fashion Week. I can visit your studio then. And it was one of the most, again, the perfect scenario. I was shooting him in studio. We were having our lunch, again, over lunch. Many a deal gets done over lunch. And he had it's such a humble and modest man. Of course, at this point, I'm well aware of who he is and his incredible empire that he's building. And, but I had never suggested anything other than, photographing him for a moment. And he said to me, would you ever consider photographing my furniture and collaborating with us? And it was one of the sweetest moments, because here's a man, extremely successful, very powerful, knows what he's doing, great businessman. Not just calling my agent and trying to book me for a job, but rather just suggesting, would I be interested? And of course, I jumped at the opportunity. I thought, what an honor, how much fun. And because I knew the man, and because I knew how important style was to him, and his sensibilities and the way he lived it. It wasn't just a store and a front, but rather I saw him in everything that he did. The way he decorates his own houses is immaculate and incredible, and his sense of taste and the way he dresses and all elements of everything that he did. And so again, even more than that, his sense of family too, which is very, very powerful with him, and the way he treated everyone around him, I always thought was remarkable, and the respect he commanded in the groups and circles that we were mixing in. For me, I wanted to inject that as well into the photographs, that I thought, you know, the way he talked about a piece of furniture was never like it was an inanimate object, but rather it was a member of the family, that it was something that you was an expensive piece for some family to buy, and therefore, you know, a sofa or a table, you know, isn't just a sofa or a table. It's rather it's the sofa that everyone gathers on every night to watch the show, or a dining room table is something that everyone gathers to around to eat at, but also people do their homework on it, and, you know, conversations are had, and coffees in the morning are had, and, you know, and it becomes a part of the world, and there's, you know, it has your fingerprints and your body is on it, and, you know, it has a sense of who you are. And he talks about furniture with that kind of passion, and so it was important to me to help bring that to life in the pictures. And we, of course, shot several campaigns together, and I both directed and appeared in a couple of his commercials. And, you know, we've been working together on many different things. I've helped him recently. I was there at an opening of his Downers Grove incredible super store, which is just phenomenal. And, you know, a game-changing show, a game-changing store. Just remarkable. I mean, you know, you were there. You remember that particular opening. I mean, what a spectacular event that was.
Speaking of that event, about 300 of us got to listen to Jennifer Hudson sing for an hour. Nigel, you were 25 feet away. Here's a little bit of her singing, "I Will Always Love You." Nigel, what was it like being 25 feet away from her and listening to her sing that song?
You know, it was spectacular. My goodness. I mean, I think that having the privilege early on to meet her backstage in her green room and chat with her, and Mr. Van was there as well, and, you know, as was Mr. Yost and several other members of Art Van. And, you know, she was a very personable individual. I'd met her once before, years ago, when she was on American Idol, right afterwards, in fact. And she was extremely charming and down-to-earth then, and she was extremely charming and down-to-earth now, as the very well-known, famous, Oscar-winning, you know, Grammy-winning artist that she is. And it is as if she hadn't really changed at all, other than the fact that we were all extremely impressed to be around her. And of course, obviously, one of Chicago's own. And I'm watching her, listening to her. What an artist. I mean, I think that in many respects, the recorded CDs that one can buy don't do her justice. You almost have to see her in person just to get a sense of the visceralness that she brings to stage. The presence that she has is phenomenal. And, you know, of course, she invited us all up to dance with her. I didn't just have to sit 25 feet away. I was up on stage dancing alongside Mr. Van and so many others with her. So, you know, an all-round spectacular evening. And what a way to open a store and to say to the people of Chicago, "Hi, we're Art Van, we mean business, and we're here for all aspects of your life, including entertainment." And he did it in great style.
If you want to learn more, www.nigelbarker.tv. And I'm Jack Russell, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Whistler. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Nigel Barker, whose latest book is entitled Models of Influence. And Nigel, you profile 50 iconic models. What do they all have in common?
Well, I mean, great question, and thank you for talking about my new book. I mean, you know, to me, in many respects, just to talk about the book for a second, slightly out of context, you know, I wrote this book because of the extraordinary women who I've worked with, and oftentimes models are given a bad rap. You know, we only really hear about models as being too skinny or too successful or too wealthy or too young, or, you know, with so many sort of body health conscious issues that are out there right now, models in the fashion industry often, you know, face the brunt of it. But, you know, I wanted to talk about the fact that models are also the face and the reason for so much change that we also see in the world that we don't often realize and appreciate and attribute to many of the models who were the face of change. And really, this is a book about, you know, a group of women who I believe are the true supermodels, the models who transcended the word model and really became iconic figures in the world at large, and mostly by doing things that were game changers, whether by changing the economic status of women in modeling and in fashion, or changing the face and the shape of fashion. You know, so for example, a Naomi Sims in the 1960s, who was the very first black model to ever appear on a cover of a magazine in 1967 in America, and the first black model to ever be on a TV commercial in 1967 as well for AT&T. And that in itself opened up the doors to women of color being able to see themselves represented both in magazines and on television for the very first time. And that's a huge game changer. So it's a book about trailblazers, about pioneers within the fashion industry, and, you know, women who shaped the face of beauty, not just epitomized it.
Let's talk about a few of these models. Elle Macpherson, please.
Well, Elle Macpherson is certainly, you know, one of the most, you know, iconic models of all time, certainly when it comes to the body that she was, you know, described as, in fact, self-described as. She called herself the body, and she talks about how, you know, when you talk to her about how she often didn't find herself particularly pretty. You know, she didn't grow up thinking, I'm pretty. You know, obviously, she's physically attractive, but she was a very good sports person at school and as a young person, and did a lot of swimming and all of that kind of thing. And she knew her body was in good condition, but she was, you know, never really thought of herself as being a sort of a pretty face. So when she started modeling, you know, she always put her body first, and she got this name, The Body. You know, one of the famous sort of commercials that she did was for a brand called Tab, which I'm not even sure exists anymore, but you may remember Tab, a cola drink, and she of course drank this drink walking down the beach in a bikini, and various couples on the beach, the men would look at her, jaw drop, and the girlfriend would then nudge the boyfriend as they say, hey, what are you doing? Anyway, this was one of the very first commercials to become a huge international success, and you could say went viral, even though this was pre-internet times. And really put her on the map as being someone to look at, and she became a very commercially viable model. You know, she was a, you know, very, very, very clever businesswoman, and that's one of the reasons why she appears in this book, is not just because of the fact that she was an extremely successful model, and to talk about her success for a second, she was on the cover of Sports Illustrated 5 times. No other model in history has been on the cover of Sports Illustrated 5 times. She's more than any other model. And she was also got married to a photographer and a man who I've worked with on America's Next Top Model, but his name is Gilles Ben-Simon, who was the creative director and photographer for Elle magazine. Now, despite the fact that the magazine was also her namesake, Gilles Ben-Simon, when he married Elle, put Elle in Elle magazine every single issue for 5 or 6 years. So for, I think it was a 6-year run, she is in every single issue. So, you know, obviously her portfolio and her brand becomes more and more famous every time she's in it, anyone sees her, and it really put her on the map. But what, for me, the biggest game changer about Elle Macpherson is that in 1989, you know, she was being offered various contracts by all kinds of people. She was a well-known individual, had a well-known for her body and all the rest of it, and the swimsuit editions and all of these things that she was working on. And a company out of New Zealand asked if she would become the face of their lingerie brand. And Elle did something that no other model had ever done before. She turned around and said, well, how about, instead of just me becoming the face and taking a paycheck, I take no paycheck, but I want stock and shares in the company, and essentially organized the very first license deal in fashion. And, of course, it was a smart idea to defer the paycheck, to bank on the fact that she had what it took to launch an intimates collection, and created Elle McPherson Intimates, which is a company which now generates, I think, $65 million a year. So it's not just made her one of the most successful models of all time, but she was the very first person to think about doing a license deal of that nature. Of course, it's second nature now to do something like that, and celebrities of all shape and form are doing license deals, but she was the very first one. And so for that reason, and amongst many, it's one of the reasons why she, of course, epitomizes that look from the 80s.
Nigel, you lead two lives. One life of glamour, beautiful people, and then a second life as a husband to Kristen and a dad to Jack and Jasmine. What's that like?
Well, I mean, I don't think that they're separate. I mean, I think my children and my wife and my life, it's all wrapped up together. And I think it's important, certainly for my kids, to see me in all things that I do. And oftentimes, if you are living the high life and traveling around the world, it's easy to separate yourself or become distant or feel that you could say that you deserve more, or you've experienced certain things and now you don't want to go back. And for me, that's never been the case, and I don't want it to be. And I very much love being a family man, and spending time with my family and my children comes first and foremost.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners, please?
Well, you know, I get asked, you know, for advice on a regular basis, certainly from young photographers and models and people like that. And I think really that my main advice, and I think you could have, you know, certainly applied this to almost anybody or anything, is that you have to believe in yourself. It's not about thinking you're better than anybody else, but rather you have what it takes to do your best job. Do what you like to do. It doesn't matter if it's slightly polarizing. You know, you need to be noticed. And, you know, certainly if you do things that are average, that just appeal to everybody, and don't take any risks, it's hard to really elevate yourself and your brand and make a big difference in the world.
Nigel Barker, thank you much. What a shining example of the advice you just gave. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.